Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exposed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and we're going to do part two, talking about why America is so divided. So, Steve, your last show was very compelling, but you didn't quite finish what you wanted to say. So, what do you think?
Yes. Well, you know, I did end last time on a pretty pessimistic note, you know, which is that I do not believe that we're going to crawl our way back up out of this. I think we have a lot further down to go. I don't think anybody should be particularly surprised that we have a lot further down to go because, you know, you name the empire, no matter how they manage to climb out of it, they go down. You know, the Soviet Union went down and was chaotic for a decade. The British Empire went down through 30 years of World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, same for the French Empire. You know, we are going to have this problem. And as I was finishing up, I remembered that I had perhaps over-summarized the development of the situation in that we were founded as two separate countries with two conflicting sets of values, and that we had spent the majority of our history through the 1920s basically reinforcing and extending the ideological divide, and in many ways even a border, you know, the Mason-Dixon line, even a boundary divide that we kept kind of oddly cobbled together, but principally in conflict with each other rather than with either the outside world or the problems of civilization. And I had remembered, as I was ending on that pessimistic note, that there was a moment, there was a moment of a couple of decades, and it was a challenging time where the problems and the crises of our society created something that looked like a path out of it, which was the populist economic policies of Franklin Roosevelt at the very lowest part of the trough of the Great Depression, 1932, when he got elected in 1933, when he started implementing his program, which, of course, then kind of ended in World War II, which was what was happening with the rest of the world's empires at that time. And we had not really completed our entry into the world empires that we had begun with World War I. And so there was this moment of populism. You know, the Southern Democrats, who were unquestionably segregationist and racist and very much the same Democrats that had run from Thomas Jefferson through the Civil War and the aftermath of ending Reconstruction and into the Jim Crow days, you know, they were still those same Democrats, but economically they were populist for the working class. They did not trust the rich. The rich is what they associated, you know, with banking and New York and Chicago and things that they rejected. They were very class conscious working class people in the racist segregationist South, and so Franklin Roosevelt was able to put together this dramatic rescue package. You know, it wasn't a conversion of the United States into socialism, but it was using public interventions in order to sort of purchase capitalism's way out of its crisis that it had, you know, collapsed upon itself at that time, and certainly created what we call social democracy, I guess, right? A new social contract in which things like that tangibly benefited the masses of Americans, like Social Security, minimum wage, union organizing protection, the 40-hour work week, things like that. So there were dramatic changes and improvements in the lives of working Americans, and everybody responded to that. You know, it was enormously popular. And it was delicate, though. It was delicate because Roosevelt knew himself that he could not try to move forward with civil rights, because that would fracture the coalition. That would send the South, the Southern Democrats, out of the coalition, looking to build something else. And so he did things like not integrate the military. He did things like not let Jews into America when they were coming from Europe as refugees. You know, kind of a a stain in both of those counts on his presidency, but one he believed was necessary and ultimately, as far as he was concerned, ended the Great Depression and won World War II and actually stopped the Nazis. You know, they do calculus on a much bigger scale than we do. But when Truman became president at the end of World War II and the soldiers came home, there was really no way of getting around. This was the first shock to FDR's coalition that happened after his death. In the aftermath of World War II, Harry Truman decided there was no way to hold off integrating the military at that point. And it was kind of odd that we had had this Civil War and that we had had the reunification and that the Union Army, you know, like the United States military, was maintaining a segregated military structure where black people were and white people were not allowed to mingle in platoons and in units and in operations. And it was the same kind of thing, right? People were concerned, well, what's going to happen to these white people if there are black people in their platoon? They won't fight. They'll fight with each other instead of with the enemy. They thought they had good reasons, but obviously because of the racial nature of World War II, it could, you know, that element of citizenship could no longer be denied. And in 1948, we actually saw the onset of the fracture. It only lasted from 1932 to 1948 because Strom Thurmond, a Southern Democrat, broke in during the presidential race and formed his own party. Technically, legally, it was called the States' Rights Democratic Party, but we've all come to know them as the Dixiecrats, right? The ancestors of what today is called the Blue Dogs, the right-wing Democrats. They grew out of the 1948 Strom Thurmond campaign, which nearly prevented Harry Truman from getting reelected. Thurmond won four states in the Deep South, of course. And so that was kind of the onset of the fracture, and it was over desegregation of the military. It was the first move by a Democratic Party president to move away from segregation, and it had its immediate effect. It shattered the Franklin Roosevelt New Deal coalition right out of the gate on that one instance. And then we kind of staggered forward. It held on through the 1950s because Dwight Eisenhower became president. The Republicans won the election in 52 and 56. And, you know, then along came 1960, in which John F. Kennedy was speaking openly about civil rights and won an extremely narrow victory over Richard Nixon in that race, one that some people still feel was stolen in Illinois by allies of Kennedy's gangster father. But regardless of that, by 1964, civil rights progress was fully underway. And although those bills in 1964 and 65 were voted on by greater proportions of Republicans than Democrats, because back then the Southern Democrats were still Democrats, and the Northern Republicans were socially liberal, we saw in 1968 that another arch segregationist, George Wallace, governor of Alabama, again broke away from the Democratic Party and started an independent campaign, a segregationist campaign, which got five states and definitely turned the election to Richard Nixon. You know, the Democrats made mistakes of their own in their nominating process by not going with their primary winner and not staunchly claiming leaving Vietnam, which the liberal American public was demanding at that time. But the fact is that George Wallace won five states and won enough segregationist Democrats elsewhere to turn the course of that election to Richard Nixon. And with that, the Democratic Party Progressive Coalition, the one shot we had, that took its first shock in 1948 and then finally collapsed in 1968 over that same thing that we were talking about, the way the country started on two separate countries. And first Strom Thurmond and then in 1968, George Wallace decided that they wanted their half of the country back again. You know, they wanted to restore that. And they went out to attempt that and had a dramatic impact on the course of politics at that point. And so, as we all know, at that time, with the Democrats holding about 75% of Congress, and having just won, you know, an overwhelming mandate in the presidential election as well in 1964, Richard Nixon decided that the way to make the Republican Party as populist, if not more populist, than the Democrats had become with the progressive agenda from the 1930s through the 1960s would be to explicitly pursue the racist demographic in the South and woo them to join the Republican Party. Now, up until that point, that was an
issue. Let me ask you this, Steve.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. In 1968, it's not a well-known fact, but Dick Gregory ran for president that year also, and he got a good number of votes. Do you think the number of votes that he got in 68 could have swayed the election?
No, I don't, because the numbers aren't there in enough states to compensate for what was happening there. But that was also part of this new realignment, you know, that I'm talking about. That was also a year. Why was he doing that? Is that he felt that the black equality movement was not finding a home in the Democratic Party. You have to bear in mind, looking back, that, you know, Martin Luther King never told anybody what party to vote for. You know, all the successful social movements of history never told their participants what party to vote for. In the 1920s, the 1930s, the labor movement never told anybody what party to vote for. The women's vote, the women's suffrage movement never told anybody which party to vote for. You know, the civil rights movement never told anybody which party to vote for. The anti-war movement of the 1960s did not tell anybody which party to vote for. They attacked LBJ. You might remember that famous chant, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Right? They went right at the heart of power, and ultimately it was Richard Nixon, a Republican, who ended the war, and not because he just randomly wanted to end the war, but because he had grown afraid of being able to control the social unrest that the war was generating. So that was something we used to know that we might need to remind ourselves right now, is that there has never been a successful social movement that aligned itself with a political party. Every social movement that has succeeded has expressly declined to align itself with a political party. I think we touched on this in a previous conversation, in that what happens when you align yourself with a party is that you've decided at that moment that you're okay with 50% of the population becoming hostile to your issue, because if you're religious Christians and you want to stop abortion and you align yourself with the Republican Party to do that, then what happens is everyone who considers themselves a social liberal and a Democrat, they automatically oppose you and they're going to fight you and they're not even going to listen to the merits of the case you're trying to make, because you're trying to help the other party defeat their party. And likewise, if you align your labor movement, your civil rights movement, whatever it is that you're doing, with the Democrats, then the half of the country that's Republican doesn't want to hear it. They don't want to hear the merits, because you're helping Democrats get elected. You're not specifically arguing to have laws passed that will help your cause. That's like secondary. You're arguing to elect Democrats on the grounds that Democrats will enact that cause. And so all the Republicans will automatically oppose it, because it's their job to make sure Democrats don't get elected. So this is a terrible shift that we've had, you know, since the end of the Vietnam War, where movements that have arisen have rapidly aligned themselves with one party or the other and become part of this classic divide that goes back to the origins of this country, that keeps reinforcing that in 1968, the divide was reestablished and firmly reestablished, because what happened after 1968 is that the two parties realigned themselves, right? In a sense, the Republicans became a national party, no more Mason-Dixon line. They became a national party that had specifically endorsed the segregationist voter, invited and welcomed the masses of segregationist voters in this country. And, you know, so that ended up creating the emergence of what we see today in our two parties, which is that we basically have a neo-confederacy and a neo-union, and it's divided by party, rather than by the Mason-Dixon line, you know, and the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Missouri, the idea that we'll keep adding more states equally on each side of the ideological divide to maintain that balance perpetually. And then the Republicans kept building on this, right? We know that in 1980 that they sought out for the first time the fundamentalist Christian vote. Fundamentalist Christians did not vote in large numbers prior to 1980, and it's because their theology taught them that worldly governments are worldly, are the domain of the world and Satan, and that, you know, very, very religious people work on spiritual purification and kind of live for creating conditions that will provide them with what they seek in the afterlife, and which side of the army they're going to be on when their prophecies arrive as they believe. So they didn't vote in large numbers. And it's kind of interesting that the first time that they did vote in large numbers, they voted for something that had previously been considered unable to become president, specifically because fundamentalist Christians would not cast such a vote, which is that Ronald Reagan was the first divorced person to become a major party nominee. And again, that was a non-starter up until then, specifically because of the concern that it would lose the religious vote. So here came in 1980, adding more of these Southern Baptist coalition, which had spent most of the 70s organizing in response to an IRS code, a change in the IRS code, where they actually started pursuing these fundamentalist churches over segregation, about challenging their tax-exempt status over segregation. And that's how they ended up with Ronald Reagan. So it, too, was another dive into the segregationist waters. It was not simply a dive into religious waters. It was specifically seeking a particular sect of fundamentalist Christianity that was organizing itself around segregation in 1980. We saw again in 1994, Newt Gingrich started this thing. Another Confederate started this thing called the Contract with America, which in its time was called the Revenge of the Angry White Man. That is literally what the press called the Contract with America and the movement around it. And then ultimately it reached its apex, you know, the end game, if you will, in early 2009, right after swearing in of Barack Obama with the Tea Party. Once again, and it's obviously a reaction to, you know, that the idea that the Democrats were responsible for the election of a black president. So we were really right back now where we were when the Constitution was drafted, back where we were, you know, in the Missouri Compromise and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And we really have to look back at the at the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, I believe, and what happened as a result of that, which is that the Whig Party, which was kind of like what today's Democrats are, right? They're the party that was always sitting on the fence. Sitting on the fence on the slavery issue, whereas the Democrats were very firmly pro-slavery. And many of the people in the Whig Party felt that the Whigs supporting the Kansas-Nebraska Act was the end of sitting on the fence, that the Whigs had become pro-slavery, like firmly chosen to be pro-slavery. And so everybody that was anti-slavery left and joined the Republicans. And that left only half the Whigs left, which obviously couldn't win elections because there was only half of them left. So they joined the Democrats. And we had a dramatic party realignment in 1856. And, of course, we know by 1860 the Republicans were electing a president. And what happened as a result of the electing of that president and the electing of many, many members of Congress, the House and Senate, and state legislatures all over the country of this new Republican Party, is that the Southern Democrats immediately seceded from the Union and decided that's the end of trying to hold this weird bifurcated country together. We're just going to finally leave now. It was probably inevitable, but now that there's an expressly anti-slavery party as one of the two major parties, they considered that unsustainable to their cause, and they immediately split and started their own country. All right, so that's kind of where we are now, and what we're seeing right now. The Democrats are treading very, very lightly in the civil rights realm. They're paying lip service to it, but they're not doing any of the things that the civil rights movement wants done. They're not reorienting the criminal justice system in any way. They're not restoring affirmative action. We just saw again in California, a state that's, you know, 2.5-1 Democrats, they put affirmative action onto a referendum, and the referendum failed because liberals are split on this issue.
So what you're saying is Harris was elevated to VP for window dressing.
You know, what is the identity game when you're doing that, right? Harris's career, which is what you want to look at, right? If you're hiring someone for a job, if you're hiring them on the basis of something about their biology rather than their career, their resume that they're bringing to the interview, then you're engaging in symbolism. You know, it's kind of out of fashion right now to call that tokenism. You're acknowledging the physical characteristics of someone. But what do we know about Kamala Harris? We know that she was previously district attorney of both San Francisco, which is where the Wall Street of the West Coast is located, and attorney general of California. And she did not mount any prosecutions of bankers after the financial crisis. And one banker in particular, Steven Mnuchin, the current Secretary of the Treasury for Donald Trump, was recommended by an independent panel for prosecution in California, and Kamala Harris declined to bring up that prosecution. But she was very happy to incarcerate parents of color if their children were skipping school. You know, people like that were arrested and taken to jail, but Steven Mnuchin was allowed to go free. And Steven Mnuchin then gave multiple campaign contributions to Kamala Harris, because when you're auditioning for career growth in the power structure that we have, you audition for that career growth by demonstrating to the people in power that if you continue to grow along a career path and get into higher and higher positions, that their interests will be served in so doing, right? They're the people that direct the course of institutional scale campaign contributions, the people that create the endorsements that provide credibility for people to go out, run effective campaigns, and attract attention. I remember back in 2002, during a gubernatorial election here, the local chair of the Democratic Party in New Paltz confronted me while I was campaigning for the Green Party and said, you know, don't you think it's important that Carl McCall, he was running, a former comptroller of New York, who was running for governor as the Democrat that year. And she said to me, don't you think it's important that if he wins, that Carl McCall would potentially be the first African-American governor of New York State? And I said, you know, actually, I'm more concerned that if he wins, he becomes like just the next in an endless succession of New York Stock Exchange executives that have been governor. Uh-huh. He's just one that happens to be black. You know, and that's how you get over on it, because I remember when Carl McCall was the comptroller of New York, and those of us that were trying to free South Africa were lobbying him as hard as we could in every possible way, including civil disobedience, to divest the New York State Employees Pension Fund from stocks that were of companies doing business in South Africa and profiting from South Africa. So that New York State would not be a stakeholder in the profitability of South African businesses. And Carl McCall, as an African American and as a former chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, said no, he wouldn't do it. He never did it. So, you know, if being black couldn't even get somebody who was the sole trustee, I mean, he didn't even need an act of legislature to do it. He could have just ordered the divestment. He's the sole trustee. The comptroller in New York is the sole trustee of our pension funds and can literally order any change that he or she would want. And what was the effect for African people and African-American people if the first black comptroller of New York State would not even take the step of divesting the New York State pension fund from a direct tie to the profitability of apartheid South African businesses? You know, so that's, yes, and that's Kamala Harris today. That's exactly why, you know, during the primaries, she was, you know, she never got better than 5% support from African Americans. The African American voter in this country wasn't remotely interested in Kamala Harris. You know, but by the time the primary was settled, it was just an assumption at that point that everyone spoke about that the way that the Democrats were going to be recognizing the rise of a new civil rights movement was that Joe Biden was going to have to nominate an African-American woman. And of course, he was looking at Kamala Harris, for out of law enforcement. He was looking at Val Demings, who was also out of law enforcement. He was exactly looking Susan Rice, who is about imperializing Africa. He was basically looking at all the people that were known to continue the status quo, but would create a photograph that looked more diverse than having the old white guy from a banking state and a petrochemical state to be the president. And so, yes, that's what they did. So, let's bring it back now, to conclude to where we ended last time and why I wanted to do a little bit of an extra kind of epilogue for it. I had ended very pessimistically and then suddenly remembered at the end that there was this one moment in 1933 where it looked like there were things that could finally unify this country to a fair degree, apart from the Mason-Dixon line for the very first time. And the reason that it looked that way and that carried through World War II is that the country had fallen into economic collapse. We were on our knees. The corporate establishment could not be trusted, and everybody knew that. And so there was something new and significant, a 25% unemployment rate to be concerned about that needed to be addressed as a crisis and set those other differences aside, even if it wasn't going to be permanent. And that rolled out into World War II, where we needed to unify and save the world from Hitler, right? That was so there was that window. And now we are in a crisis again, and we could theoretically use those same principles. But unfortunately, the divide has grown even bigger because it was so easy along the terms of the division to swiftly turn the pandemic into another culture war, into another part of the divide where half the people didn't even believe it was a serious crisis, that it was being manufactured by their enemies on the other side of the divide, rather than just being a disease that we would have to deal with on medical terms. So I'm going to leave now today the same pessimism as last time. We're not going to get out of it.
Our time is up again. So we'll continue this conversation. You've been listening to Steve Greenfield. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. And if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Steve. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.